This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Italian authorities are being pretty cautious in their reaction right now. They haven't claimed any kind of guilt. They haven't admitted to apprehending the wrong person. They've simply stated that they are looking into it and performing all the proper checks to confirm the identity of the suspect.
That's reporter Chris Lifsey in Rome. Regarding reports, Italian authorities arrested the wrong man in a major migrant smuggling ring. Details next.
Also this morning, African Union and Somali government forces successfully beat off an attack by al-Shabaab attackers. And in Libya, a militia favoring the UN-backed government in Tripoli has penetrated the Islamic State's stronghold of Sirte on the Libyan coast.
We'll have these stories and more. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, one day after announcing a major arrest in a migrant smuggling operation, Italian prosecutors are now trying to determine whether they have the wrong man in custody. Numerous people say the man being held is really Medhani Tesfa Mariam Kadani and not Medhani Yadego Merid. He was detained by Sudan last month and extradited to Italy this week. Reporter Chris Livesey is following developments from Rome. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Italian authorities are being pretty cautious in their reaction right now. They haven't claimed any kind of guilt. They haven't admitted to apprehending the wrong person. They've simply stated that they are looking into it and performing all the proper checks to confirm the identity of the suspect. So it's all still a mystery at this point. Photographs of him were part of the question surrounding his identity, photographs of him taken at the airport upon arrival. Family members and friends saw them and immediately recognized them as being that of somebody different from the suspect who was allegedly in custody. The two people, if in fact this is a case of mistaken identity, share the same first name, but the rest of their name is completely different. And when you compare the photographs, at least those that I've seen, and I'm not any expert on this type of thing, they do appear to show some discrepancies. I mean, it looks like the real suspect is several years older than the person they have now in custody.
Did the prosecutors say when they might have a new statement regarding this?
No, they haven't said anything like that. And both prosecutors in Italy and law enforcement in Britain, because Britain was collaborating with Italy in this investigation, they haven't said when they will or if they will come out with any new information regarding this person's identity, simply that they're looking into it. Britain in particular has said that they don't question the methods by which he was apprehended, but that isn't exactly the same thing as saying they don't question the identity of the person they apprehended.
So no one mentioned the methods used by Sudan at all, because that's where he was detained.
Precisely. From what I've heard, it's been suggested that perhaps Sudan extradited the wrong person. But again, this is all speculative at this point, and the authorities in Italy and Britain are moving very cautiously right now before they say anything that could be misconstrued. I mean, if this is in fact true, obviously it would be very embarrassing. European law enforcement is eager to nab a so-called kingpin. In this case, the suspect they have or thought they had would be a big fish. And if they got the wrong guy, well, they'd certainly have egg on their face.
That's reporter Chris Livesey in Rome. VOA's Joe DiCapua also spoke with Maron Estefanos, someone who was well known in the migrant community. She has a radio program called Voices of Eritrean Refugees that's broadcast on Radio Arena in Paris. From Stockholm, Sweden, where she's based, she told Joe that questions arose about the detained man's identity immediately after his photo was published.
They published the actual smuggler's picture, but when the Italians published him arriving at the airport, then I was shocked, just like every Eritrean that knows this person and that knows the actual smuggler. Everybody was saying this is the wrong person. Just to be sure, I spoke to families of the wrongly arrested man, friends, childhood friends, and I tried to find out as much as I could about him. And at the same time, I also contacted the refugees that were smuggled by the actual smuggler and sent them the video clip from the Italians. And everybody confirmed that this is not the right person. This is not the smuggler that smuggled them into Europe. So I confirmed it from both sides.
So tell me about the man who is actually being held. Who is he?
The man who's being held, his name is Medhani Tesfamariam Kidane. He's just a refugee that came to Sudan in 2015, in May 2015. He's just a refugee living in Sudan who has nothing to do with the actual smuggler.
So how do you think he was detained by the Sudanese authorities? Was it just a case of mistaken identity?
Not really. I mean, Sudan has been rounding up Eritreans for the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks. They've been deporting Eritreans back into Eritrea. This is as a deal of the Khartoum process, a deal with European Union and the Horn Africa countries. The last 3 weeks, many people have been arrested to be returned to Eritrea, and he happened to be the same way. This person was at a cafe having coffee with his friends when they started rounding up, and they arrested him. And then because he happened to have the first name, the same as the smuggler that they're looking for, somehow he got extradited.
So tell me about the man who they were actually looking for. Does he operate out of Sudan?
He was operating from Libya, but since last June 2015, when the European Union said that they were going to go after the smugglers in Libya, he felt unsafe. So he decided to go to Sudan and operate from there while somebody else is operating his business for him in Libya.
So are you getting any word about what's happening with him from your sources?
He's still a free man. He's still in Sudan.
And I assume he's in hiding now.
Well, it's difficult. The thing is, Sudan is one of the most corrupted countries that I know. All kind of things happen. As long as you have money, then you are powerful. So this person, he feels that he's untouchable by bribing people or by paying money. He thinks they're not going to get him.
So are you or other activists or migrant and refugee organizations calling on the Italian government to take certain action regarding the man that they're holding?
Yes, together with the family, we just found him a lawyer right now. This lawyer that we have found is highly recommended by many people. So I'm hoping through this lawyer we will get to clarify things and that he would be released and then that he receives a proper apology.
And I assume you want him to be given asylum there?
Yeah, of course, that would be great for him. But then again, I don't know what kind of process, you know, there are all kind of laws. So I don't know if that's possible. But for now, my main concern is that he gets released, that it's clarified.
That's Mirana Stefanos, host of the radio program Voices of Eritrean Refugees. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
In other migrant news, German authorities say an argument over when to eat during Ramadan most likely led to an arson attack at a refugee shelter in Dusseldorf. The center operated by the Red Cross was destroyed. It housed more than 280 men, mostly from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and North Africa. 8 men have been detained. A mattress was set on fire and the flames later engulfed the building. Also, European Union ministers meet tomorrow on the migrant crisis. They're looking for ways to slow the flow of new arrivals from North Africa. The EU ministers' meeting in Luxembourg will also deal with the turmoil in Libya. Most of the migrants and refugees sailing to Europe leave from Libyan shores.
African Union and Somali government forces today successfully fought off attacks by al-Shabaab militants. The assault took place at two military bases on the outskirts of a Somali village about 260 kilometers north of Mogadishu. There are conflicting estimates of the number of al-Shabaab fighters killed. The figure ranges from 85 to 240. Al-Shabaab media report killing 43 African Union peacekeepers from Ethiopia and losing 16 fighters. The chairman of Hagen Village told VOA reporters several dozen al-Shabaab attackers died and 5 villagers were killed in the crossfire. Suicide car bombers and truckloads of al-Shabaab fighters first struck the African Union base housing Ethiopian troops. Ethiopia says more than 100 insurgents were killed, but did not say how many of the peacekeepers from Ethiopia died.
In Libya, a militia favoring the UN-backed government in Tripoli has penetrated the Islamic State stronghold of Sirte and is within 5 kilometers of the city center. A brigadier general told the Associated Press today that the Misrata militia has crossed a major bridge in the city and has encountered little opposition from ISIS fighters. The militia supports the government of National Accord. Misrata is one of several militias trying to defeat ISIS forces in Libya. Sirte is the only major city held by Islamic State fighters outside of Iraq and Syria.
Nigeria has more than its share of internal strife to deal with, and President Muhammadu Buhari faces multiple armed conflicts after a year in office. Much like Boko Haram in the northeast, all of these conflicts began as clashes within individual states. And like the Boko Haram uprising 7 years ago, these clashes have the potential to become unmanageable national crises. David Arnold has the story.
When Mr. Buhari, a Muslim from the north, ran for president in 2015, militants in the Niger Delta in the south threatened to escalate their bombing attacks on the nation's oil pipelines. Joe Siegel, the research director for the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C., talks about those threats.
Now, we haven't really seen that come to pass. In fact, there seems to have been ongoing dialogue between these groups and the Buhari administration. And that's where it is interesting to see if what's unfolding with the Niger Delta adventures, whether that is foreshadowing a larger militancy and a resurgence of fighting among some of these groups.
Militants in the southeast were subsidized by Mr. Buhari's predecessor, President Goodluck Jonathan, who offered to hire the militants to protect the pipeline they had previously attacked.
Some have suggested that many of the militants under the Avengers are unhappy that the Buhari administration is curbing funding for a sort of amnesty program that the Goodluck Jonathan administration had had so that they would transform their movement to a more peaceful movement that would be focused more on job creation for its members.
The Avengers are not the only threat to Nigerian peace and security. They have vowed common cause with a handful of militant forces long hostile to Abuja.
They are claiming support for independent state of Biafra in the southeast, for which there was a very costly civil war in the 1960s. There have been some clashes in Kaduna state where supporters for the Islamic movement in Nigeria, a Shiite-based movement, had clashes with security forces. The clashes led to up to 350 deaths. And the arrest of the leader. There have been some clashes between Fulani herdsmen and farmers of Benue State in the north central region of the country. So this will give you a sampling of the sorts of internal conflicts that Nigeria is trying to come to terms with.
Siegel says the slow development of Boko Haram violence in Borno State taught Nigeria that if you don't take care of local problems early, they later become major struggles for the federal government. Boko Haram grew to be one of the most destabilizing groups of armed Islamists in the world.
That group became increasingly radicalized, and we saw a growing frequency of clashes between the government and Boko Haram. The government was criticized for not responding more forcefully, more quickly, and this was a result of a perception that this was a local challenge, this wasn't a national threat.
Siegel believes that when Nigeria's military chief of staff and his convoy drove through the city of Zaria and clashed with local Shiites last December, the large number of civilian deaths in that city was the result of the military's new policy of quickly responding to local threat.
The relatively strong and relatively early show of force by the Nigerian security sector in the clashes in Kaduna with the Islamic movement in Nigeria, as well as in trying to curb the growing militancy of the Niger Delta Avengers, suggests that the government is not going to tolerate a great deal of restiveness in these areas.
The Africa expert says the government needs to look carefully at the roots of these struggles and to identify the social factors that can reduce the potential for greater conflict.
In many of the sorts of internal security threats that we're seeing in Nigeria, you know, there are strong social factors that are behind the tensions. Unemployment, a sense of marginalization, poor governance, perceptions of corruption. And so absolutely giving more attention to these governance issues and providing more investment and economic opportunities will go a long way to reducing any popular support for these movements.
Can Nigeria, the size, the economic complexity, and ethnic diversity of a country of 181 million people, avoid such destructive conflicts of interests?
Or are these clashes the beginning of a more organized and separate internal conflicts that are going to create bigger headaches for the country? I think it's still too early to say where that's going. Nigeria is seeming now to get to come to terms with what's going on in Boko Haram, I think does provide an opportunity and some optimism that they can turn the corner. And so ensuring that these other clashes don't become bigger threats, I think it'll be the key challenge for the government here over the next 6 months to a year.
The responsibility for Mr. Buhari's administration is whether these regional conflicts can be resolved through political or military means before they become insurgencies as costly to the nation as Boko Haram has been. David Arnold, VOA, Washington.
Twenty-one past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The World Health Organization has declared an end to the most recent outbreak of Ebola in Liberia. The announcement follows a 42-day waiting period during which no new cases were reported. Despite being initially declared Ebola-free in May of last year, the virus has re-emerged three times since then. The latest cases were linked to a woman who had traveled to Guinea, where she was exposed to the virus.
Also, a new study reveals potential Ebola hotspots. It says they are widespread across Africa and that the virus is carried by a greater number of animal species than suspected. The study, published in the science journal Mammal Review, was led by scientists from the Center for International Forestry Research, CIFOR. It challenges the preconception that the Ebola virus is mainly carried by fruit bats. It found numerous potential animal carriers, including rodents, primates, hoofed animals, as well as civets and shrews. Professor John Faw is one of the lead authors of the study and a researcher for CIFOR. He spoke with me about the findings and the implications for the hunting and eating of bushmeat, the term commonly used for food from these wild animals.
The most important aim of what we were doing was to actually see whether we can understand better the factors that may be linked to the presence of the Ebola virus. So in order to do that, we need to look at both environmental conditions, in other words, you know, type of forest, climate, etc., but also the likely animals, the animals that are likely to be the host for the virus itself. As you well know, sort of viruses don't live on forest leaves, etc. They actually live in actual animals. So by doing the work that we have done, we are able to better map the areas which are favorable for the Ebola virus. And in so doing, we can then start looking at these particular areas and hopefully come up with an early warning system that will say, well, these areas are more likely to be the places where the disease might happen.
What are some of the areas that you all found to be hotspots?
The areas that are clearly hotspots are forest areas within Central Africa. For example, the western part of the Congo Basin is a very important area for the Ebola virus in terms of favorability. Also West Africa. But of course, what we do find is that there is a very strong association between the type of forest and the Ebola virus itself. Tropical forest areas are the ones where the Ebola virus seems to like. Now, that doesn't mean that it can't occur somewhere else at some particular point in time. What we're saying is that given the information that we have, there is a very strong association between tropical rainforests and Ebola virus.
Is it carried by the animals that are in these tropical forests?
A virus actually requires a body of an animal in order to survive. Without that, it can't actually do its normal functions, basically reproduce and infect other animals. What the story has been up till now is that there are only three possible species of mammals that may be the transmitters of the disease. And these are three bats, three foot bats. We show in our study that we've got to be cautious about that because currently there isn't sufficient evidence to actually clearly state that these three bats are the only ones responsible for the transmission of the virus. We show that there is evidence out there that tells us that there's a wider range of animals that may possibly be implicated. The analysis that we have done says that there are a number of other species that could be the carriers of these particular viruses, and therefore we have to look at the picture in a different way. Doesn't mean that we have to go out and start killing everything that is in the list of animals that we have in our paper. It means that we have to understand the processes.
I understand what you all have here is that approximately 60 or more species of animals are flagged as potential carriers. If you could just name a few of these animals that are carriers of Ebola.
Well, there are species in the list that we knew that had been in a way implicated in the transmission of the virus. For example, primates and all that. When we talk about transmission of diseases in different parts of the world, we know there are certain species that are more likely to be the carriers than others. I mean, after all, 75% of all of the diseases that humans have started in animals. Zoonotic diseases is what we're talking about.
As a bushmeat expert, what would you say are some alternatives for people who do go out into the forest and hunt for food?
What we see, for example, in places like Nigeria and some of the countries in West Africa, is that obviously immediately the Ebola sort of struck. A lot of hunters weren't actually going out and taking certain types of animals. You know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done with the communities on the ground, especially hunters, to see how we can actually, in a way, eliminate the risk of transmission of disease from animals that they hunt, which they have to hunt.
So what is your next step from this report? What do you intend to do now?
That's a very good question, actually, because this is a very first step. And the first step is to actually look at the information that we had in relation to animals and possible transmission from animals to humans. Now, the next step has got to be to look at the transmission dynamics of human to humans.
That was Professor John Faugh, a researcher at the Center for International Forestry Research. He spoke with me from Manchester Metropolitan University in the UK.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa. Your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, I, yeah, yeah. This one, I, yeah, yeah.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.